Welcome, everyone, to Howling Coyote. And I'm privileged this week to have Sarah Wright with me, who's a professor of geography at the University of Newcastle in Australia. And she has many credits to her name, and I'll ask her to add anything more that she wants to say about herself. I'm just really excited to have this conversation with her. So Sarah, say hello and add anything that you want to add.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much. And thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to have the chance to chat today. I just want to say that I'm zooming in from Goombanga country on the mid-north coast of New South Wales in Australia. And I want to start by acknowledging the elders past, present and future of this land where I'm zooming in from. It's actually just dawn here because of the time difference. And I can just see the sky lightning outside at the moment. It's a beautiful place. And just to say this always will be Aboriginal lands that have not been, sovereignty has not been ceded here.
Well, how about that?
Looking forward to chatting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I should add that I'm speaking from the homeland of the Penobscot Nation. And I wish to acknowledge their elders past, present, and future. So, I was just really taken with your paper, More Than Human, Emergent Belongings, A Weak Theory Approach. And I'd never heard of weak theory before. And I found that really interesting. And it also comes upon, it's timely for me because I signed up for a course. I always take one course every semester. And I signed up for a course on the philosophy of belonging for the fall semester here at the University of Maine. And so I'm really interested in your thoughts and some of the projects that you've been doing to introduce people to the Indigenous Australian understanding of belonging to the land. And maybe we could start by your talking about belonging, because in the paper you begin by saying that belonging is a puzzling term. So if you could tell us more about that, I think that would be awesome.
Yeah, thanks. I find, belonging it is. It's one of those terms that people use all the time as if it's really self-evident. I mean, it's an important term to people. You hear, it's amazing how often, I speak to people in my work, perhaps asking, say with interviews and the things that people will bring up, they'll talk about and really center this idea of belonging and also of not belonging, actually. So this experience of being alienated or excluded is also really important to pay attention to. But in this piece and in my work, it seems that although people talk about it as if you should know what it is, and there's not that much of a sense. It's actually a very fuzzy kind of term that can be used in many different ways, from things that are very progressive and, supportive of people, supportive of their attachments, their love and emotional attachments to each other and place, but also that sense of not belonging, of setting up boundaries so that, forms of belonging that might be based on white supremacism or, exclusionary ideas of belonging. So it's a mistake to sort of think, oh, belonging, that's a lovely, warm, fuzzy term, we should go with that, without following some of the ways that it's used. And I guess then trying to support ways, more nourishing ideas of the term in the way that people relate to other people and place in different kinds of ways. So I try to trace that a bit in the article and in my work.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because the colonizing form of belonging is, I take this and it's mine, and the rest of you get out. And the indigenous notion of belonging seems to me to be more reciprocal, that I engage in a relationship of reciprocity with the land upon which I live. And it informs me and I inform it. And together we go somewhere. Does that make sense? Am I getting it?
It absolutely does. And it resonates a lot with my understanding and my work as well. There's amazing work of Aileen Morton Robinson, who's an Aboriginal scholar from Australia, who talks about possessive belonging. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it definitely is a very powerful critique of these colonial ways of belonging, and that might be premised, as you say, on ownership, but also exclusionary kind of ownership and taking of land. And so she's really challenging those ideas. And that's a really powerful and important critique, I think, of a non-Indigenous or kind of colonialist understandings of belonging and place, relationships with place. But then, as you say, Indigenous conceptions of belonging open up different ways of relating to and as place. Many Aboriginal people in Australia talk about country as place, country with a capital C, referring to land, seas, skies, people, all the beings and belongings that live in a place, whether seen as sentient or not, in a kind of Western conceptualization, and most importantly, the relationships and emotions and senses that create and co-construct people and place together. So it's a very beautiful and important and profound kind of understanding of relationships and belonging to and as place, not creating these separations.
And certainly in North America, among the Indigenous view is that all aspects of the land are conscious beings, mountains, rivers, lakes, everything. And one of the really interesting things that I've experienced is that mountains walk around. I don't know if that happens in Australia, but here in North America, they move. And I was once at a ceremony in eastern Washington State in the Columbia River Valley Gorge. And I was with some Yakima people. And I said, "Do you guys know that those mountains move?" And they said, "Oh yeah, they like to walk around all over the place. Don't pay any attention to them. Just don't fix your directions by wherever they are." And then I had the same experience. I was with the Seri people in Baja California, and which is Mexico. And there were also mountains that walked around. And I said to them, "Look, they move." And they said, "Yeah, they do that. Pay them no heed."
So, oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like, you know, that that acknowledge or that recognition, that acknowledgement of the agency and the sentience, intelligence of all life, including rocks and rivers and things, is such an important part of belonging. And, you know, that talking about mountains, it makes me also think about the importance of sort of understandings of time, where for some things like rocks, for instance, if the movement and the ways that they might move and act, you know, the time scales are so much longer. It's sort of like a rock time, or there's a starfish time that might, you know, the cycles are more quickly going around, all the time of a cicada, which is kind of up and out, and in such a short kind of burst after laying dormant in the soil for such a long time. These if these things aren't paid attention to, or again, in that kind of colonial or Western way, it can seem like, oh, well, that rock's not doing anything. Whereas really, if you have the patience and are open to those long time frames, it's, you know, in Australia, Aboriginal people have been here for 60,000 and more years, really forever, as long as the land has been here. So seeing those kind of movements and those kinds of communications from non-human beings, it's an attentiveness to it, the time, the different kinds of time scales.
Yeah, and you make me think about the whole notion of Indigenous knowledge, that this way of receiving information from the rocks, from the mountains, from the rivers, that's really dismissed in conventional academia, for instance. And yet it seems so relevant and powerful. And it might be a good lead in to asking you to talk about weak theory, which I had never heard of before I read your paper.
Yeah, I'm really drawn to the idea of weak theory. I think in part because of its insistence on openness then, and just coming off from that conversation we were just having of paying attention to materiality, not being bound in by two dualisms, what's alive, what's dead, what's human, what's non-human, but rather, you know, following and being open to the different kinds of emergences and entanglements that are there. I thought that weak theory was a particularly interesting way to be thinking about belonging as well, because of that thought that, well, belonging being such an open term, meaning so much to so many people, it's not the kind of thing that you then should be closed down, because then that does, I don't know, even a violence, I guess, to the way that the ways that the belongings are. So with weak theory then, which is something that comes out, which I came to through E. Sedgwick's work, we're seeing as thinking of a reparative theory, a theory of repair that's looking at connections and it's being open to what's there. And I just found that really refreshing and different in terms of an academic approach, where, you know, in contrast to sort of theories or sort of ways of saying, no, it must be like this, or you must really focus on a singular answer, it's this kind of openness of being able to trace these kind of intimate threads and entanglements, and with a strong attention to emotions and affects, so that it really brings in a broader kind of understanding and is open to that.
Yeah, and it made me think of Indigenous logic. I interviewed a woman named Rebecca Sinclair, who writes about Indigenous logic. And it's this idea that A and not A can coexist, that they're not mutually exclusive, that A and not A can both be true at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, and it also made me think of fuzzy logic, that things are not black and white, that there's a lot of gray in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that's such an important thing about that sort of A and not, or just opening up to these different logics. I did a degree actually in pure maths, as my undergraduate, something that I don't mention too often. And I just because it's not sort of, well, now that I work in very different spaces, but I still find somewhere some things that I find very useful. And I, for instance, was doing a bit more work in logic, and it opened up to me how, from a mathematical point of view, you have to set your assumptions as well about logic, and then everything else flows from there. So, you know, your first step is to kind of look and see, well, what are these assumptions? Can we have A and not A at the same time? And that's actually kind of this kind of basic point from which other things flow. So I'm really intrigued. Actually, one of the communities that I work with here in Australia is in Arnhem Land at Bowaka. So the, some Yolngu grandmothers who are... one of whom works in the, as a principal in a Yolngu bilingual school in far north of Australia, and they've really designed a whole curriculum around Yolngu mathematics, Indigenous mathematics, but most specifically Yolngu mathematics. And some of the things that they really try to do is map these kind of concepts, or not map them, but be true to a Yolngu ontology around what kind of patterns and understandings there are and how to understand patterns and of the world, which ultimately keep and hold everything, so that Indigenous mathematics and Yolngu mathematics and Yolngu and Indigenous logics are really important in structuring relations, people's relationships with each other and with place, and have so much lived and deep insight around relationships with the world. And I thought that was really intriguing. I mean, the way that the community have really wanted to speak about some of these relationships as mathematics, to push back against kind of Western conceptualizations of what maths is. And so actually kind of politically using that term in a way, but also pointing out how actually mathematics can be such a broad idea when it's about patterns and relationships, and that those kinds of structures are everywhere in everything.
Indeed. And it made me think about earlier today, almost randomly, I heard a discussion of quantum entanglement. And I realized we have no idea how that works. I mean, we know that it's there. We know that it happens. But we have no idea how it happens, or at least I don't think we do. I mean, maybe someone does, but I don't. And yet it's so fundamental to this notion of interconnectedness and interdependency. In the language around here, it's called netulunkamek, which means interconnected and interdependent. And it's really interesting that the locals had a word for that. I mean, the locals here in Maine, and that they understood, you know, that everything is interconnected, and that any movement in one place affects every other place. And that seems so sophisticated mathematically, as compared to colonial mathematics of the same time. You know, we're talking about the 1600s. And I don't know, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the it feels like, you know, these so-called kind of great advances and cutting edge new theories and so forth from kind of a Western scientific perspective is, you know, often enough it's like, oh yeah, of course, you know, it's there. Indigenous people in so many different contexts and are having different concepts about relationality and about more than human agency and about co-becoming and how humans are so intricately bound in their world, and how our very being is made up through relation. So on the one hand, it's sort of, and you know, but I think there is an important, and there is important work pointing out and critiquing that as well. I know in the social sciences, you know, around post-humanism and You mentioned before that that's something that's often not paid attention to in an academic space, but it can also be, you know, like the big new thing to understand. Oh, wow, people actually are related to their environments. Wow, that's just incredibly new, cutting edge and exciting knowledge. I mean, it is exciting, sure, but to think that it's new, or to, I guess, try to claim that territory from certain kind of white, westernized kind of academic spaces is really problematic as well. So I think it's important in this work, and I mean, to acknowledge the different intellectual lineages of much of this knowing, as we put it, and resist very much the sense that academia is now suddenly discovering, it's like an intellectual colonialism, discovering these concepts of interdependence and relationality. And there's some really wonderful critiques out there by Zoe Todd and others talking about the kind of colonialism inherent in some of that approach to knowledge.
Indeed. Though in the United States, we're still staunchly entrenched in empiricism, rationalism, reductionism, and all that entails. Though I wondered, there was a book I read called Introduction to Nomadology. And it was written, I don't know if you know that book, but it was written by an anthropologist and an Australian elder and a painter. And they walked around in northwestern Australia. I think it's called the Kimberley or something like that.
Kimberley.
Yeah. And everywhere they went, the elder told them a story from that place. And he said, well, you can't tell this story unless you're standing in this place, because the story belongs to this place. And so if I was in another place, I couldn't tell this story because it doesn't belong. And it was such a fascinating book. It really moved me. It was focused around Broome, which I guess is a city in the Kimberley, or a town. I'm not sure. I've never been to the Kimberley. The closest that I've been is to Perth.
I haven't read that book, but certainly that connection of stories to places and the importance and agency of places is so fundamental in so many in many Aboriginal cultures. One example that for me is working in Arnhem Land with the grandmothers. We've written a book together on called Song Spirals, which is very much about song and its ceremonial keening for women and its relationship with place, and the way that it actually actively creates and makes place, but is also made by place. We were having kind of conversation and going over something, just clarifying in our book that we were writing together, and asking what words to use. And we were at the time at a different homeland for a funeral for some sorry business. And we went through and we had to correct all these words that we had been using, Yolngu words. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, who knew we made so many mistakes last time? Thank goodness we're correcting them now. And then at some stage in the conversation, I realized that it was not that the word was wrong, the words were right, but we were in a different place. So there was different right words. Those words were not the right words for the place that we were telling the story in right now. the appropriate word was the word of that place and of that moiety to be used in that way. So, I mean, it's even the very language of the land and to be used around things like sunsets, you know, that's the sunset of that particular place. So rich and important to be paying attention to those specific connections.
Indeed. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the migrant experience, because, I mean, we move around. And I mean, for myself, I was born in southeastern Kentucky. And here I am in Maine, which is the far northeast of the United States. And in some ways, I'm not from here, so I don't fully belong. And in other ways, this is where I live, you know. And when I go to ceremony in South Dakota, I feel so drawn, so connected to that land. And which is potentially, I mean, I have 5 candidates for who was my father. So one of them lived in South Dakota. One of them is Lakota from South Dakota. And I feel so connected to that land when I'm there. And yet here I am back in Maine. So, you know, I'm sort of a transplant. I'm from away, you know, and even though I work with the 5 tribes, and I've worked with them for the past 7 years, I will always be from away. I will never fully belong. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think that's, well, I think, I mean, that's an experience or a feeling that I share, my, you know, my heritage is from being of English, Welsh and Irish descent heritage. I was born in Sydney, and then have moved around and now been on Goombenga country for the last 7 years. And I very much have that sense of, well, knowledge of that kind of, my belonging is, you know, a complex kind of thing, which I'm, on the one hand, I am a guest, I'm an uninvited guest, and even my presence here is only allowed for or made possible by colonialism and by these possessive belongings that kind of have of stolen land in this area, land stolen from Goombenga people. So negotiating or recognizing that, I think it's, I guess it's, I have thoughts about my sort of belongings, but also a broader thought that I think the, with the weak theory and belonging and with the work that I've done is a recognition that actually belonging is complex for everybody, even when people, so for instance, many Indigenous people or people who I work with here, like Aunty Sha Smith and Uncle Bud Marshall, who are elders in this community, Goombenga elders, although in the belonging that they speak of is so rich, it's so embedded into their very being and with their ancestors, and old fellas of this place, it's still, when they speak of their belonging, it's still a complex and fraught kind of thing in that case because of colonialism and lived experiences of being not belong, like of being told that they're not belonging, of Uncle Bud being an an elder being excluded from school or from hospitals and things. So, and the everyday racism that is around that still has messages of not belonging for people as well. So I think that idea of belonging, of seeing it as a complex thing, and then I guess though then nourishing or looking for ways to nourish respectful ways of coming together that and relationships with the land as a good guest, so that it's an active process of, I mean, it's now speaking for me, an active process of nourishing relations and building good relationships and trying to be a good guest, a responsible person who listens to what country has to say here and is aware of and tries to follow the rules of the Indigenous laws of the place, but also knowing that that is not something that I can claim for my own, and that I can, that I'm in relationship with that though by being here. I find that Anisha speaks of that everybody, that this is sort of the time for everyone to, I guess, call in their ancestors and create connections, but not in ways that erase kind of violences or exclusion, but nourishes the actual connections and the good relationships as we can. Yeah. And I find that's one way that I try to kind of think about those belongings, without being paralyzed by the problems, but supporting the kind of more tentatively open and nourishing ones that we can make.
And it, there's that experience of not belonging. And I mean, even though, well, for myself, I'm part Indigenous, part European, as many people are in this country now in the United States. And so I have the experience of not belonging to the land in Maine or to the Indigenous people in Maine, not entirely belonging to the people in South Dakota from where my possible father comes. And, you know, there's a certain alienation that exists for many of us of where do we belong? That we have the experience of not belonging to many places, but where can or do we belong? And can the land accept us even if the people who live upon the land do not accept us? Can the land embrace us even if they don't? You know, they say here in Maine that you, in order to belong, you have to live here for 7 generations. Well, that's not going to happen for me. So I don't know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I guess it can't, I mean, for me, it comes back to a bit to the sort of processes and being okay with partial kind of understandings and finding ways that partial belongings, maybe you're now, I guess, still in your first generation, but I feel like that's still a movement, or that, yeah, sure, that being kind of looking for the kind of partiality of our belongings and being aware that it can't all be kind of complete. I feel like one of the things as well that I think is important is the idea of kind of practices and the doings and beings, so that for me, I find it useful to let go of an idea of completely belonging. And actually doing this research makes me think like, that's not, feeling completely belonging is not necessarily a good thing, because I think people who really want to shore up their belonging often in the literature, I mean, that's sort of to me a bit allied with sort of that kind of, again, these problematic ideas of borders and white supremacy and people like in Australia, the sense of wanting to control the border, who comes in and so forth. So there's a lot of problematic things, especially for me as a non-Indigenous person, around asserting strong claims of belonging. So that partial belongings can be nourishing and living practices and supporting the practices, not saying can it ever happen, but where are the bits where it is happening a bit and where can I nourish that and feel those belongings, pay attention to country and listen to when country's talking to me and reflect on my own relationships, not in a way to make claim of 100% belonging, but to be where I am and to nourish where I can, both human and more than human relationships.
Well, and it draws me to the part of your paper where you talk about emotions as relational. Yeah. And this idea that emotions exist at the borders, at sites of contact, and that if I read you correctly, that this sense of belonging arises out of the emotions of relationality. Is that a fair interpretation of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Emotions of relationality and practices, so that these two things can also be bound together and they're sort of coming into being together.
Yeah.
So that emotions are important. And, you know, I was thinking as well about the importance of grief and of pain as well, so that actually sometimes belonging with people comes through the experience of pain. So it's not always necessarily only kind of positive, warm, fuzzy feelings around belonging. And that there is an important place for that. I mentioned briefly before about song spirals and the ceremonial singing from the Yolngu women from Balaka that I work with. And actually the ceremonial singing of the women is a crying, is a pain, singing for the pain of those in those relationships with country, with other people, for people lost, for the non-belonging, all the times when things aren't good. So I guess it's also honouring those as well. And that can include the sense of feeling or acknowledging that belonging is partial and conflicted, and that alienation and not belonging is really part of our experience.
Yeah. There was a passage that I really liked. You wrote, belonging is an impulse for some sort of attachment, be it to other people, places, or modes of being. And the ways in which individuals are caught within wanting to belong, wanting to become, a process that is fueled by yearning rather than the positing of identity as a stable state. Belonging is both being and longing, as subjects and their belongings desire to connect and reconnect differently. Belonging becomes not only an affective, but a strongly embodied experience. And I found that very powerful, that particular passage. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, thanks, Aish. It was great to hear you sort of read that out. I was feeling kind of moved when you were talking, looking outside and thinking it's been a beautiful conversation, reflecting on my own yearnings and my own belongings around it. And I think, I guess, attending to those yearnings and is taking the time and the patience to be with where we are and feeling those kind of attachments. It's a beautiful thing in and even in its pain potentially. If we kind of sit and try not to rush through, you know, life can be constructed to not attend to those feelings and those yearnings, those belongings with place, particularly in the kind of Western colonial kind of world of belonging being either around identity or around a job and things. But just to take the time to kind of pause and nurture and attend to those times. And I guess sometimes if there is feeling of not belonging, what is it and why and how to react to it? You know, in a university setting, sometimes not belonging is or feeling of not belonging is a message that maybe it's time to walk away from that situation because it's not where your yearning is and that there's something wrong with it. The different kinds of ways it can guide and teach us, I guess, those senses of belongings and those yearnings that we do have, the attachments.
Yeah, and I was thinking maybe we could turn our attention. I was really taken. It seems like that you include the land as a co-author in your writing. Is that Bawaka country? Is that correct?
Yeah, Bawaka.
I mean,
yeah,
I've not seen that before, and that was quite impressive. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so that's the collaboration that I've been talking about with grandmothers from Bawaka country, Laklak Buruwanga, Wichilili Ganambar, Ngarakiwai Ganambar Stubbs, and Bambapoi Ganambar are the sisters who I work with, particularly there. And then two other non-Indigenous academics from down south, Macquarie University, Kate Lloyd and Sandy Suchet Pearson. And together we work for coming up on 20 years together now. And we started co-writing collaboratively at first doing the co-authorship list of all of our names of the humans. And then I guess at some stage along there, one of the things that, you know, we were really trying to do is attend to the messages and really the knowledges of country, like we've been talking about, the ways that, you know, there we are writing about weaving, but how can, when you're weaving, you're getting taught by the materials, by the pandanus, you're guided by even what to talk about, by where you are and by the weather, these kind of the teachings that come, and even to the authorship of the paper, what topics are discussed, how are they discussed, what learnings have been given and shared onwards, that we had the idea. It was actually Sandy who then asked my mom was, oh, should we be putting, you know, recognizing country in some way as an authorship? And, you know, of course I was like, oh yeah, of course, oh my god, we should, of course, that's the owner. So it was not so much like, again, that idea of sort of quote unquote discovery. It was just sort of more like, yeah, all along that is so obvious that should have been done. But it does take a bit of a shift out of that westernized mindset to think about doing it, because we're so kind of, I don't know, acculturated into, of course, an author is the human. That's who we're talking. So it's been... It's been something that we've been doing for quite a while now, is acknowledging Bawaka country and, you know, constantly looking for the ways that Bawaka does hold and guide and write and teach and lead that research collaboration and the specific writings and papers that we do. And yet at the same time, acknowledging that country, humans are part of country as well. So it's not separate that we're being taught by something separate, but rather through those relationships, through this kind of co-becoming.
Another paper of yours that I read was Co-Becoming Bawaka, Towards a Relational Understanding of Place Space. And I thought it was so intriguing. You say, we invite readers to dig for Gunguri, which are yams, adding with Bawaka. And in so doing, consider an Indigenous-led understanding of relational space place. And that whole notion of encountering and interacting with the land is so non-academic and yet so powerfully academic, I might say.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just really taken with this notion of digging for yams. And I wondered if you could say more about that.
Yeah, and I mean, we try in the writing to remain true as far as possible to that, in that it's not like a kind of construct or a metaphor or something. It really is the digging of yams and to the learnings and guidance and feelings and beings and doings that come about at that time, sort of processes to actually, you know, structure the conversation and structure the yarn, as people would say in Australia, the discussion. So it's a more than human and very embodied experience. And then what does that tell you? You know, sometimes when, you know, just the practice of writing something, you know, you sit down and go, oh, what do we start with? What goes where? How's this should be structured? And, you know, we try to be like, oh, we'll throw that out, that head kind of structure plan thinking, and just trust, go with Gunguri or go with what's being taught, what's being taught on that day, what's the sand doing, what's the Gunguri doing. Actually, that was in terms of the evolution of trying to push this around into academia, that paper was quite a important one because, you know, I think the journal was relatively supportive. Journals have been relatively supportive, but obviously it's a bit outside the academic box to be, you know, there's even forms where you have to write who's the author and what's the author's email address and what's the author's title and things like this. So, you know, with that one, it was great that journal, which is Progress in Human Geography, which is a pretty influential journal in the geography space, was supportive in following through. So after that, we were able to then kind of point to that and say, oh, look, they can do it. You can do it too. Even if your form is struggling, you know, you can make it work a bit harder to make these changes. And that's kind of worked out. But even that notion of being really true and really led to by Gunguri, by the yam in that case, you know, we did have one reviewer who was saying, no, this is, you know, you need to restructure it, you need to do blah blah blah. And it was the first time as a group that we, you know, really doubled down and wrote to the journal saying, sorry, we're not doing that, we're not doing that. And it was Gunguri who really said, no, don't do that. Don't restructure it to put the literature up the front and have it all kind of a more formal Western academic and site anthropologists who can prove that that's the way that things are done. Follow Gunguri and do that and push back and remain true. And actually through that kind of process, that article was able to be published. against the will of the one reviewer, in part because we had other fantastic reviewers and they sent it out to someone else and it worked around. But yeah, so it's an interesting, I mean, it's part of the process to really, really follow and learn from that.
Indeed.
And of course, working with the grandmothers, they don't have any interest in what the forms say that you meant to do. They have knowledge of the Gangurian interest in communicating what they want to communicate, and it's up to my job and to make sure that comes through as best as possible and fight for that space to be made in a more kind of formal Western sort of academic space.
Indeed. And the other paper of yours that I read was about fishing for Wakun at Bawaka, and yeah. I hope I'm pronouncing it sort of correctly.
Wakun.
Yeah. And that was a really cool paper too. And can you say a little bit more about that paper and that process?
Yeah, again, that was sort of that time when we were really trying to work or challenge that academic writing style to be as open as possible. I mean, obviously, there's you can't communicate these ideas in English or even in writing. I mean, Wakun, the mullet, has its own knowledges and ways of working that aren't transferable, and that humans, even for the Yolngu families, it's outside their experience, let alone readers not from there who don't speak Yolngu and aren't Yolngu and don't have those relationships. So I guess it's always partial, but the communication is still really strong. And that was a beautiful paper to write, and to even to rethink about, because it's speaking very much about Wakun, and I can imagine and be there, feel there, it's speaking really about that those ideas of relationality, of people as place, but also the authority of country. Country has authority both as an author, so author authority, but the sovereignties and knowledges of more than human beings in country, to honour those agencies, to listen and attend to those agencies and help them guide behaviours, whether it's in research behaviours or any kind of relationships that we do have in the world through our co-becoming, the sense that we emerge through those relationships and those need to be attended to.
It makes me think of I have a couple friends who live on an island in the north of Australia called Mullangimbi. Do you know that island?
Yes, I know that is, yeah.
And so their names are Shadow and Lily. And Lily holds the record for spearing Barramundi on the island. And Shadow has amazing stories of hanging out with crocodiles. And when I sit with them and I hear their stories, I feel so immersed in their sense of belonging to that place that holds all those things that emanate from that place, the Barramundi, the crocodiles, the spears, all of those things. And there's a sort of envy because I can never be of that place, that I can only participate from a distance in their sense of belonging to that place. And I don't know, does that ring a bell for you? Can you say anything more about that?
Yeah, I mean, both to the strength of the belongings that the family up there have, and I mean, there's also the layers as well of the stories and the songs and the song lines of the ancestral belongings is something that I reflect on as well, to think, oh, imagine having the ancestors of the place where you are be your ancestors back untold generations in that place, and to have those songs and those stories still be living on the land where you are. So that's the depth of those connections. And I just, as an aside, the just incomprehensible greed and arrogance and blindness of colonizers to not see that or to ignore it, and to speak of an empty land and terra nullius as they did in Australia, it's unbelievable. But yeah, my relationship to that, I guess I can, you know, when you go, I guess one thing that I find when I am visiting there is, because in Arnhem Land, those strengths of connections and the grandmothers who I work with in the Yolngu world, when they have visitors who are not Yolngu, they need to be placed in the system of Gurutu, which is the system of kinship, in order to become visible to country, and also to have sort of relationships and responsibilities as well. So they place everyone, including me, into this system of kind of kinship, which is, you know, not about suggesting people or are the same or anything like that, but it is it does mean that there is a guidance of how to relate as a guest, but also as connected, because ultimately everyone is connected, and there is these kind of belongings and relationships. And with the Yolngu grandmothers, and as is common in Arnhem Land, is that, well, there's pre-existing law and relationships and stories there, and the way to kind of invite people in, or that way to maintain that, is to keep that as the main central system and then place people in it in kind of relationships. So that provides some kind of, I guess, understanding about those obligations that you might need, which in no way is akin or parallel to the depths of the connections that you were talking about or that people experience, but it is, I guess, a step on a journey, or a tentative kind of guidances around kind of ways to relate to those belongings, even knowing, as you say, that that's something that we can't ever experience on that level.
Yeah.
But of course there's, I mean, the traumas of colonization as well that are there as well as part of that too. I mean, not to sort of romanticize either.
Yeah. So I think we're drawing toward the conclusion of our conversation, which has been really fun.
Okay.
And I just wanted to bring up one more of your papers that I read, which is Revisiting How We Learn in Academia, Practice-Based Learning Exchanges in Three Australian Universities. And I thought it would sort of be a nice conclusion to reflect on how can we change academia, the academy? How can we make it more experiential and transformative? And I think that's what you're writing about. And I thought that might be a good conclusion, is to think about how can we do that?
Yeah, it's a hard one at the moment, actually, because some of the things and the thinking, I guess, what we were talking about in that paper, you know, was involved in more experiential kind of processes that students have. And again, that relationship building. And certainly that's an important part of it still, but I'm also aware that since that paper was written, there's been the pandemic and, you know, the sort of big changes and restructuring in the university sector here in Australia anyway, where things are tighter and tighter kind of financially, and the sector is heinously underfunded. So, you know, some of these things, they take time and they take support, and it's almost, well, the struggle to change the momentum from back to be moving back towards more experiential and practice-based understandings and taking the time with students. It's yeah, it's going to be, it's in a challenging space right now.
Indeed. And this, the same thing is happening with us for other reasons, or similar reasons, or both.
Although I don't want to end negative, so let me just say that I do think that the students are really, a lot of them are very open and interested and hungry for that. So and there still are important openings and relationships and learnings that are coming through. So it's a big thing to shift it back, but there is hunger there from people. So just to end on a slightly more positive note, because it's not all about the recalcitrance of the university. It's also about the openness of people to make change. And I think there's openings there.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you for joining me. And it's been really fun. And I hope that we may have further conversations in the future.
Absolutely. And thank you so much. What a beautiful way to start the morning. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you. I can now report that the sun is up here in Australia.
Oh, how about that?
We've been through the dawn. It's time to get up.
Yeah. Well, the sun is still up here, but it's going down. It is heading down.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. All right.